You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
My name is Chris Rogers. I work here at Open Society Foundations with our regional policy initiative on Afghanistan and Pakistan. RPI conducts research and advocacy on conflict-related human rights in both Afghanistan and Pakistan, from drones to detentions, as well as civilian casualties in military and counterterrorism operations. This event, I think, comes at a very critical moment and time in Pakistan, as well as in the region more broadly. Dan and Ali and I had a bit of a back and forth earlier this week on what exactly should be the subjects of our discussion. After which I sent them a list of about 100 or so of my top most important questions, which is to say there is a lot of ground to cover. There's the drawdown in Afghanistan, upcoming presidential elections there, peace talks right now in Pakistan, as well as the prospect of a major military operation in the Taliban stronghold of North Waziristan. The situation is extremely complex and seems to be changing daily. Violence in Pakistan has increased significantly in recent months, and the government continues to be accused of serious human rights abuses connected with the conflict as well as its own counterterrorism operations. So with so many issues, I think having two experts such as Ali and Dan can help us wrap our heads around the bigger picture, where we are in Pakistan, where we're headed, what are the most serious threats to open society, and what can be done about it. So, with that, I'll introduce our panelists. Ali Dayan Hassan is the Pakistan Director at the Asia Division of Human Rights Watch. He has led HRW's research, reporting, and advocacy on Pakistan since 2003, most recently on sectarian violence and enforced disappearances in Balochistan. Before joining HRW, Ali was senior editor at Pakistan's Herald magazine and recently served as a visiting fellow at Oxford University. Ali is a regular and probably prolific commentator and opinion writer on Pakistan and international and national media. Daniel Markey is Senior Fellow for India, Pakistan, and South Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations, where he specializes in security and governance issues. From 2003 to 2007, he served at the U.S. State Department, advising in South Asia as a member of the Secretary's policy planning staff. Before that, he taught politics at Princeton University. Dan has published extensively on the region and most recently is the author of the book No Exit from Pakistan, America's Tortured Relationship with Islamabad. Dan and Ali will each give about sort of 5 to 10 minutes of introductory remarks. After that, we'll pose some questions on some key issues to have hopefully a bit of a debate and back and forth between them. And then we'll open it up to the audience for questions and further discussion. So with that, again, thank you very much for coming, and I will turn it over to Ali for some opening remarks. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. The problem I find with any discussion about Pakistan, particularly when it happens in the US, in New York, or in DC, is that it is a conversation that centers around security for the most part. Now, this is, of course, on the one hand, understandable because the Pakistan-United States relationship primarily is a security-driven, security-centered relationship. However, Pakistan is an increasingly complex situation, and the state and society itself is driven by imperatives that are greater than just security, including the relationship with the United States, where on the one hand you find that actually it would suit the Pakistani military to maintain its alliance or its patron-client relationship with the US unhindered by negativity. But the political compulsions that the military faces, both in its effort to preserve its institutional preponderance within the Pakistani state system, and also for reasons of power play with the US, requires it to pursue and encourage a public politics that is deeply anti-American. It is quite fascinating what happens as a consequence, because that politics is pursued, there is mobilization around it, often it is an anti-rights politics, it is things that concern me, and then the state government, the military itself, finds itself becoming hostage to to these public positions that are either an attempt to negotiate with the U.S. or to appease and placate public opinion that is anti-American, because of course the fact is that Pakistan is a deeply anti-American place. Now, what is happening in Pakistan itself? What is happening in Pakistan is that the state is in many ways weaker in terms of how it negotiates with its international partners the whole process of, on the one hand, democratization, and on the other hand, the rise of the TTP and Al-Qaeda Inc., if you will, as adversaries of the Pakistani state, has led to multiple centers of power emerging, and therefore Pakistan does not speak with one voice. There was a great loveliness to from an international conversation point of view to General Musharraf's dictatorship, which is that you picked up the phone and you talked to this one person, and well, he was, in as far as you can be in Pakistan, maximum dictator, and he could make things happen. And that is simply no longer the case now. There are competing power centers that often work at cross purposes. What is happening to Pakistani society itself is that there is an increasing level of brutalization, and the most vulnerable actors in Pakistani society are being targeted with greater and greater ferocity by extremist elements that were, until a certain point, allies of the Pakistani military, and in many ways remain still associated perhaps with elements within the military and intelligence establishment, but also attack it at the same time. So you have these awful records that have emerged in the last couple of years. The worst attack ever on Christians in Pakistan took place last year when a church was attacked and some 80 or 90 worshippers were killed. The worst attacks on Shia Muslims ever in Pakistan's history have taken place in the last couple of years. The Hazara community, which lives largely in Quetta, this is about 500,000 people, and to put this in perspective, the Shia are about 20% roughly of Pakistan's population. There hasn't been a census in almost 20 years, so these are all approximations. And that would mean about, say, 20 odd million people. The Hazara are 500,000 of those 20 million people. They live in the city of Quetta, which is a provincial capital in Balochistan province. And they live really in what is effectively the Warsaw Ghetto. It is an appalling situation. These are people who have been driven into their neighborhoods, and the Lashkar-e-Jhangvi, which is a Taliban and Al-Qaeda affiliate, attacks them with greater and greater impunity within those enclaves. This may seem like just a business of suicide bombings, and there's a way, and even an analytical process of dehumanization that occurs where you say, oh, see, a suicide bombing, no matter how bad, it may kill 100 people, as an isolated event. But it's not an isolated event, because when people don't have freedom of movement, when they are ghettoized in that manner, they can't go to university, they can't go to schools, they have been deprived of an opportunity to earn livelihoods because they can't go to work. There are increasing levels of unemployment. On my last research trip to Quetta, I realized that this unemployment and poverty, which was increasing, was exacerbated by the fact that even basic foodstuffs almost double in price when in the process of making their way into the ghetto. So, because it's dangerous to get them in. And we are not talking about an isolated rural place far away. This is the capital of one of Pakistan's provinces where this is happening. In addition, across the country, Shias are being targeted by virtue of name. And these are not necessarily politicized people or political actors. These are professionals going about their daily lives. Increasingly, also, the state, military, the paramilitaries are being targeted by these same groups. So whereas previously there was an easy sort of for you know, purposes of argument, you could say, oh, the Pakistani military supports militant groups as an instrument of national security policy, and actually they're their allies, and actually they need to stop supporting them. And if they stop supporting them and turn the tap off, the matter would easily be resolved. And now, actually, the reality has become considerably more complicated. I think that we should, Dan will have perhaps more to say on this, and perhaps even disagree with me, because right now, as I understand it, there is the US imperative is to have the Afghan Taliban on board for a peace agreement and to effect a safe exit out of Afghanistan in the terms of the drawdown. The Pakistani imperative is to attack and kill the Pakistani Taliban because, well, the Pakistani Taliban don't want to be creatures of the Pakistani state. They don't want to be allies of the Pakistani state. They want to either take over the Pakistani state or destroy it. And so this is slightly inconvenient, even if you are a pro-Islamist interior minister, say, in Pakistan. You still want to be interior minister, and you will not be that if Mullah Omar is the caliph who presides over the proceedings, so to say. And so there is, and at the moment, for example, when we are looking at these operations in North Waziristan and so on, there is a complication, and the complication is, how do you attack some of these people and let others be when they are all embedded into one another, and there is very little separation between them? Within Pakistan itself, in Pakistani society, there is a bigger problem, and that is that extremism and militancy is not something removed from the Pakistani condition. It is a fault line that runs the length and breadth of Pakistani society. And if you look at the recent negotiations between the TTP, the Pakistani Taliban, and the state, the TTP have done something very clever. They did not send three cavemen from deepest, darkest Waziristan to negotiate with the Pakistani state. They appointed four Pakistani party political leaders to negotiate on their behalf, including Imran Khan, who is the leader of the second or third largest party in Pakistan. And basically what they did was they mainstreamed themselves in the conversation as a consequence, and they actually showed Pakistani society the mirror by saying, this is actually your problem. You have an ideological civil war with one another, and you don't know, as a country and a society, where you stand. And I have really sort of, in my limited understanding and reading of the world, seldom seen a situation where you have people who ostensibly sign up to a state, who claim a patriotism, if you will, who claim to be elected representatives, representing a movement that seeks to overthrow the state, that does not recognize your constitution, and that has killed 50,000 of your citizens. It is a remarkable situation, and one that bodes ill in the medium term and the long term for human rights protections, which are my principal concern in life, for social space, for an open society. And of course, it has all the problems, inherent problems, in terms of national security and international security that lie therein.
Thanks very much, Ali. Dan.
Great, thank you. Thanks for the opportunity to be here. Ali said that many in Washington are inclined to place the U.S.-Pakistan relationship in sort of securitized form. I may be somewhat guilty of that. I just got off the train from Washington, D.C., so don't hold it just against me. It's partially just the city rubbing off on me. But what Chris, when he framed the questions, and he did actually pose about 1,000 questions, He framed them, though, in three broad categories, and so I'll try to address the categories of questions that he raised. And they were fairly simple. Where are we with respect to our relationship with Pakistan? Where are we headed, and what should we do about it? So where are we? It's 2014, and the dynamic of 2014 is sort of the ending of a chapter. And this is really an Afghanistan story. And in that respect, it's securitized because we've been at war in Afghanistan since shortly after 9/11. And it's the end, as all of you are aware, of the heavy U.S. military presence in Afghanistan and the beginning of this transition to what we are not precisely sure. But the one thing is fairly clear to me is that, and I think to most Americans, that the end of the Afghanistan war is not shaping up the way anybody would have liked it to, in really any way that we can think. And now the question is whether things are bad or whether things are going to be really bad and what role we can play in helping them to be less bad, that is, to retain a degree of stability and security within Afghanistan so that it doesn't bring more trouble to Afghanistan itself, to the region, including Pakistan, but not limited to it, and to the wider world by way of international terrorism and other problems. And I'm afraid that the latest round of this debate really centers on the question of the Obama administration's debate over how many troops to leave behind inside of Afghanistan and whether we are seriously contemplating what is now being called the zero option, which is to leave no troops behind, and what that would mean for Afghanistan. And I'm fairly concerned about what that would mean, and I think I'm in good company on that because, as far as I can tell, no one in the region, that is the vast majority of Afghans, as far as I can tell, by way of their political leaders other than President Karzai, the other neighbors to Afghanistan, including Pakistan, but beyond Pakistan, including India, Russia, China, probably even Iran, would all prefer that we not leave precipitously and that we not leave sort of on the next plane out, but that we leave behind a degree of force, if only to try to shore up Afghanistan's own institutions, including its security institutions, over a period of time. And the fact that the zero option is still very much on the table, I think, reflects a frustration, certainly, within the White House with the Karzai government and with Karzai himself. It also reflects a frustration and an aggravation and an exhaustion with the broader war in Afghanistan, which I think is acutely felt, and rightly so, by many others in the United States. And it reflects, though, I think, in the end, a sense that either the bluff, if it is a bluff, is not a costly one, that it can be rolled back, or that, quite seriously, they are willing, that is, the White House is willing to pull our forces if they don't get this deal on a bilateral security agreement, which strikes me as a rather artificial situation, given that the primary obstacle to the bilateral security agreement is one individual, that is, President Karzai, and who will be leaving office likely by sometime in April, May. So I'm quite concerned about the way that this is shaping up and where we are and what it means for our relationship with Pakistan. And in particular, Ali talked about the connections between the Afghan Taliban and the Pakistani Taliban. I'm worried that as we think about this end game in Afghanistan, we are also falling into a trap which may not only destabilize Afghanistan, but destabilize Pakistan as well. Over the long run, and this relates to this attempt to try to make a distinction between, say, good Taliban and bad Taliban, Afghan Taliban or Pakistani Taliban, this is not to say that they are all the same. They're not. There are distinctions and differences within them. But far too many of them are committed to a view of what a future Afghanistan or Pakistan should look like that would be profoundly troubling to us, and then, of course, to the human rights and style of life that would be true inside both Pakistan and Afghanistan over the long term. So I'm worried about the second piece of Chris's questions, the trajectory that we may be on. And I'm worried that the poison from our experience in Afghanistan may continue to infect our relationship with Pakistan for the longer term future. You know, sitting in Washington, it's really hard to find anyone who is not, if not passionately angry about Pakistan, at least very troubled by the strategy and approach to the Afghan war that Pakistan has pursued over the past decade. The sense that Pakistan has supported U.S. adversaries, enemies, and the sense that Pakistan has been, in many ways, sort of playing, we say often, a double game throughout this conflict. This is felt very acutely. And it's going to continue to be a problem. This is one thing that I'm worried about. It's going to be a problem because most Americans who are familiar with Afghanistan and Pakistan now, from the past decade of experience, see Pakistan primarily through the lens of the war in Afghanistan. Not least because hundreds of thousands of Americans have served inside, either in uniform or as civilians, inside of Afghanistan, and have perceived, either rightly or wrongly, but have perceived Pakistan's behavior as being unhelpful to their cause. And so there's the poison there. And this is quite different. I mean, if we think historically, this is quite different from the view of Pakistan that many Americans held decades ago, that Pakistan was our ally in the Cold War. Pakistan had a lot of political support in the halls of Congress, throughout the U.S. government, and especially within the U.S. military. And that has changed very dramatically over this past decade, almost night and day. And that will have a long-lasting consequence for us. It isn't, though, just the war in Afghanistan that's the problem. And this gets to some of the deeper underlying problems in Pakistani society that Ali was talking about. That is, if we were to walk away from Afghanistan tomorrow, and if somehow Afghanistan were not to cause us future trouble, Pakistan itself would still have connections with organizations that are deeply troubling and should be deeply troubling to the United States. And here, in particular, Ali was talking about sectarian organizations, especially Lashkar-e-Jangvi, Sipah-e-Sabha, and so on. But you might go further to Lashkar-e-Taiba, an organization that has both a violent and extreme ideology with consequences for Pakistan internally, but also for the wider region, and especially for India. And these are the kinds of, and their links with Pakistan's state are the kinds of things that will trouble the U.S.-Pakistan relationship likely for years to come, really no matter what happens in Afghanistan. So that's a quick way of saying that I'm concerned about the trajectory that we are on, that we, the United States, are on with Pakistan. Now, there are some potential areas for hope, or if not optimism. We have seen a new national security strategy coming out, an internal security strategy coming out from Islamabad of late. Efforts at political and economic reforms that I think should be supported and in some cases applauded by the United States and by others in the international community. If the Nawaz Sharif government and Islamabad more broadly can see through to actually implementing some of these efforts that it's articulated, then these would be positive steps that are worthy of some support. But as I said, there's a deeper underlying poison in the U.S.-Pakistan relationship that will affect our ability to be supportive in these areas. So what are my answer to the last piece, recommendations? What should we do looking ahead? The first thing I would say is we need to take a broader perspective here. Regionally, the Pakistan relationship over the past decade has, for obvious reasons, been seen through the lens of Afghanistan. As we draw down from Afghanistan, that will still be true for all the reasons I've laid out. But we need to think about Pakistan in a broader context. Pakistan is a big country, 200 million, possibly to 300 million by mid-century. And it borders countries that we care a great deal about, even more than we care about Afghanistan, right? India, China, bordering the Arabian Sea, Iran. This is a very important part of the world and will continue to be so as Pakistan grows. And it's a nuclear-armed country. That's not changing. That's not going away. So we will have considerable interests in Pakistan's trajectory, whatever happens in Afghanistan. And we can't allow, in some ways, that poisonous experience that we've had over the past decade to determine everything about our future relationship. So what ought we to do? Well, I think in terms of seeing it in that broader context, we need to think about the positive aspects of Pakistan's potential links with other of its neighbors, and especially with India. The solution, if you think about a long-term solution to many of Pakistan's ills, will partially come about through Pakistan reforming itself. It will not come about dramatically or only by way of U.S. Change or sponsor change. The United States cannot fix Pakistan. But it can help to open Pakistan to its region, and especially to India, particularly through trade and investment. And those kinds of relationships are the sorts of things that I think the United States can facilitate, ought to facilitate, both through public and private means, and will over time, I think, lead to the kinds of changes, growth in opportunities, improved incentives for better education of Pakistan's people, and connections in positive ways to the wider region. And I will try to sell you not just my book that Chris mentioned, which is available, by the way, on Amazon, but a free report, which is free. There are a few copies, I think, outside, but also it's available online through CFR's website. And it basically sketches out what I think should be a wider regional strategy for the U.S. relationship with Pakistan, and one that focuses both on the positive aspects of regional economic integration and also the threats to our longer-term interests that would come about if we don't see Pakistan in these terms. So I'll leave it there and look forward to the conversation.
Great. Thank you very much, both Ali and Dan. I think that puts a lot of different issues and questions on the table, and I think also pretty clearly some different perspectives to these questions as well. And picking up on your comments, Dan, about the sort of poisonous relationship that has developed largely because of U.S. engagement in Afghanistan, I guess I would ask to you, Ali, what is the view in Pakistan about U.S. withdrawal in Afghanistan, and how is that impacting their sense of security and strategy?
Look, the thing is that the these are two different things. The poisonous relationship and the views on the withdrawal are two different things. The fact is that the poison cuts both ways. Pakistan is a deeply anti-American country. It has a great level of almost of hatred for the U.S. and I'm talking about public opinion. This is, and actually, what has happened is that the power centers within Pakistan are, and they've created a lot of this. They've fermented a lot of this. So it's not that, you know, it's sort of indigenously occurring, if you will, but they are hostage to it now. So what right-wing political rhetoric in Pakistan is that the U.S. is evil and they want the U.S. out of Afghanistan. That's what Imran Khan says. All problems in the region would end if the U.S. disappeared from... It is not... Whereas the Pakistani national security establishment, both for reasons of relevance, economic benefit, and national security, knows perfectly well that there is nothing more harmful to Pakistan than an immediate U.S. Exit. I mean, if the U.S. follows the zero option, well, guess what? Guess who's going to be most worried? It's the Pakistani military who's going to be most worried, because this really doesn't suit them at all. So there is a disconnect between the politics of it and the security imperatives of it. And that, in a sense, is a Pakistani contradiction. But Dan said something else that is very interesting, which is about the whole Pakistan in the regional context in India. There is a problem with this, and the problem with this is that the Pakistani military, right or wrong, whether I would agree with it or not, is the principal stakeholder within the Pakistani state system. And the U.S. has been unable to, and is, I fear, incapable of, offering the Pakistani military or persuading the India to offer Pakistan the bare minimum it requires to engage in détente, if you will, with India. And this is not about trade, and this is not about... because what you are having is the MFN status being blocked by the Pakistani military. There is a total political consensus in Pakistan today that all political parties want trade with India. the military is not on board on this and keeps blocking it again and again. Because, I mean, many years ago, we've been saying this for years, there has been this, the peace in Kandahar, the road to peace in Kandahar lies through Kashmir and so on. Well, and I mean, and I'm more sympathetic to the US because I feel that given that Pakistan is its client, we have seen the limits of US leverage even with Pakistan. So, you can't blame the US for its lack of capacity to actually get India to be seen to be offering Pakistan something. And I think that this is actually not just about, it's about optics. The Pakistani military has to have something to sell to itself and its own people. And India is, not, by way of a concession from India, and India is not willing to offer that something, which could actually even just be symbolic. We came close to this in 2007 under General Musharraf, whatever else my views on him may be. That was the one thing when he jettisoned and abandoned every traditional Pakistani position. And it was a historical opportunity in a moment, and I think that India missed that moment. And now perhaps, as we are on the cusp of a very abusive, unpleasant from our perspective, government in India, possibly a BJP-led government, but it may have the political wherewithal to offer Pakistan that kind of face-saving, if you will. And that's actually what it points out to.
Yeah, please.
Yeah. this is a really interesting piece of the puzzle. It's just one piece. But, I was in Islamabad earlier this month, and I had an opportunity to go to a place that was actually very well described by Phil Reeves on an NPR report, a new mall, a mega mall in Islamabad, where they were showing the movie War, W-A-A-R. And I got to sneak into one of the showings a little bit late, but I was able to watch, and most of it's in English. And it's a really fascinating window, and I think it bears quite well on this point, window into a kind of a nationalist take on the security challenge that Pakistan is facing. And what's fascinating about it is the kind of the drawing together of two disparate threats that the United States would never put together. The threat of the Taliban, or the Pakistani Taliban, and the threat of India. The two of these are drawn together in the movie. Indian agents are basically running Pakistani Taliban to kill noble Pakistani police officers and agents inside of Pakistan and to sow mayhem throughout the country. Now, from a U.S. perspective, this sounds relatively absurd, that the Indians would actually favor the Pakistani Taliban, so completely opposed to a worldview that suits India's purposes. And yet, this is relatively widely perceived, both in the Pakistani military establishment and more broadly than that. And movies like this reinforce that perspective that India is sort of an implacably hostile foe to Pakistan and will never change. So there is this narrative, and I agree that it's very strong and it's deeply counterproductive. But it's important also to recognize that some of this can change. It's not just, so the Pakistani military under Musharraf did see India in different terms, narrowly different terms, that I think can actually be replicated. As I understand it, President Musharraf was able to convince his core commanders to pursue a limited and ultimately unsuccessful normalization process and a back-channel dialogue with the Indians. He was able to convince them to do this on the narrow argument that it would be better to open up and sort of to normalize or pacify the relationship in the near term so that Pakistan could live to fight another day over the long term. Not peace, but normalization is what they were seeking. And the logic was, India is growing rapidly. India is growing its military rapidly. Pakistan doesn't stand a chance to fight this fight unless we find a way also to tie into that growth and economic opportunity. So we need to do this for our own purposes. We will not resolve Kashmir or other outstanding disputes permanently, but we'll find a way to sort of resolve them enough to avoid a war in the near term and keep ourselves strong over the long run. Now, I think that argument still holds sway in certain parts of the Pakistani military. And I've been saying when people ask about whether there's an opportunity for an Indo-Pakistani rapprochement or a move in that direction, I've been saying, wait till about June or July of this year. You'll have a new Indian government, could be Modi, whatever, but it will be in place. It will probably reach the same strategic calculation that every Indian government has reached over the past decade plus, which is there's no military solution to the problem of Pakistan, no lasting military solution, and we need to get back to the table. Even if only for tactical reasons, we need to talk to the Pakistanis rather than fight them. And the Pakistani government by that point may be in a position, and this will depend on whether Nawaz Sharif can consolidate his security position and deals effectively with the immediate threat posed by the Pakistani Taliban, the TTP, the violence in Karachi and some of the other major urban centers, and whether he can also consolidate his position with respect to the new army chief. Who's really calling the shots in this relationship, or could they even reach a sort of a manageable working partnership of sorts? If the answers to those questions are broadly yes, or close enough to yes, then June, July of this coming year could be an exciting time, an opportunity for India and Pakistan to get back to a dialogue. I'm told that they are still talking quietly between them. You know, we're not hearing a lot about this publicly, but it's still ongoing, and that is, I think, a hopeful sign.
So I want to come back to this question of, you know, what are the possibilities for change and I don't know about optimism, but change in direction in the future. But just real quickly, to come back to the what seems to be this more immediate question of North Waziristan, I guess I was wondering if you could sort of what your predictions are of, you know, what the nature of a prospective military operation in North Waziristan will look like. And perhaps to just play a bit of devil's advocate, it seems that as if both of you are at least on some level supportive of military action in North Waziristan. And I guess I wonder, you know, to what end? There was a major military operation in South Waziristan, of course, but also in Swat Malakan several years ago. The military is still in those areas. It was accompanied by and ended up having a legacy of very, very serious human rights abuses by the military and other elements of the Pakistani government. And this would be an operation launched in Fatah, in a place in which people have no rights. They don't have the right to vote. They have no legal rights, no access to courts. And so I think that's deeply, deeply concerning. So I guess I would just like your reactions to that, as well as your predictions of what that operation would look like.
But from a rights perspective, I think that it's pretty straightforward. In order to establish any kind of meaningful rights regime, you need to have state sovereignty, state control of the territory. And at the moment, it is, you know, Jihad Central, and everybody is there. And the state is not in control of the situation. So you can only begin building a rights framework when the state exercises its authority. Now, that requires a military operation. And more importantly, from a Pakistani perspective, yes, I certainly support military action against the Taliban, because they are human rights abusers guilty of atrocities that amount to war crimes over and over and over again. And they need to be held accountable. And quite apart from, of course, this, as a Pakistani, I face an existential threat from this set of actors. Who do not just intend to take over the state that runs my life, they intend to take over my life and very possibly end it. And this is a problem, you know. It's an I think it needs to be dealt with. But of course, there is a problem, and the problem is that it is, while you may have military operations in the tribal areas or in North Waziristan, the risk is, and this is where the government's desire to appease comes from, that because they are spread out all over the country, there will be major retaliatory action and terrorism in the Punjab. And the day the Punjab, which is the heartland of Pakistan, becomes, say, like KP has been, then that semblance of a state, of a viable state, of a functioning state that is so important will be seriously eroded further. And the politics of the Punjab does not allow for that kind of political trauma. They have no experience of it. So the stakes are very high for Nawaz Sharif. And yes, one of the ways of countering that is to have an influx of prosperity by having trade with India and so on. But all of this will have to happen at the same time. And unfortunately for everyone in the Pakistani state who, for good reasons or bad, wish to appease the TTP, the TTP are not in the business of being appeased. So when, because their idea of peace is that they want territory, i.e. Fatah or North Pakistan, they want their 4,000 people whom they say are under arrest released and handed over to them, and they want, last I heard, $1 billion, if you please, in reparations for their people killed. They want an army, they want $1 billion to buy arms, but then they want territory. And it's really not going to be fun after they have all of this. So that peace is untenable. Any version thereof is undeliverable. And therefore, it is not just that military action has to take place. Military action is inevitable. Should it be rights respecting? Should it not be abusive? Yes, of course.
Yeah, I agree with, I think, all those points. I guess I would say we as outside observers need to be thinking about what we should, in the best case, expect from such an operation and not oversell it in our own minds. At best, this will be a costly but not extraordinarily costly effort at disruption. I think it would be a bridge too far to anticipate that this would even necessarily lead to the beginning of bringing in kind of a sustainable writ of the state in parts of these places in a reasonably time-bound way. In other words, the Pakistani army is going to go into these areas. I mean, I'm fairly convinced that the Pakistani army has decided enough is enough, and they will do it. They are waiting for a full green light and a political backing from Islamabad because they don't want to have their other flank, that is their political flank, being attacked while they're in the midst of this new military campaign. So they will go to war, and they will punish the few who are still remaining in these places. Because they've certainly signaled to everyone that it's coming. So if you're still there in North Waziristan, it means either that you're foolhardy enough that you want to put up a fight, or you're not very smart, or you're desperate and you didn't have somewhere else to go. If you're a leader, if you're sophisticated, you'll probably have found a way to scoot out just in time and avoid that first operation. Which leads to questions about how sustainable this will be. And this relates back to the points I was making about Afghanistan. If the place that the leaders of the TTP scoot out to is neighboring Afghanistan, and there's nobody on that side of the border to block them or to deal with them once they're there, then we have a problem that will continue, will persist, and will return to this part of Pakistan, to the Fatah, after the initial military operations are over. So sustainability is going to be a critical part of this. And then the longer term only way to get a sustainable solution is, as Ali was talking about, is to bring together the writ of the state through a normal administrative civilian process, which the Fatah has not known in its history. So this is more of a generational project than a next couple of years or 6 months. So if we set our standards at the level of, can this be disruptive enough to, say, get rid of some of the IED manufacturing facilities, to disrupt current plans that the TTP may have for other operations, to round up the few individuals that they can catch and incarcerate them for a period of time. If that's where we set the bar, then this is both, I think, a necessary and potentially useful operation. But to set the bar much higher than that and to raise the subsequent questions about, what kinds of abuses and so on will take place, well, there will be some. I think we need to be realistic about that. But the trade-off at this point is probably one that, Ali is representative of many Pakistanis are willing to make it.
Just very quickly, picking up on that, if the long-term strategy here has to be extension of the writ of the state, mainstreaming Fatah, so to speak. I guess I wonder, from your perspectives, are there, here at Open Society, we're trying to support groups and organizations, particularly within a country like Pakistan, who are pushing for precisely that, right? And those are not within the military, they're not within the security establishment necessarily, though they might have to agree with that on some level down the line. But I guess I wonder, when you look at civil society and political parties in Pakistan, are there forces there that are trying to push for a more rights-respecting strategy in Fatah? And particularly, if mainstreaming really is what we mean by that, right? You know, what are the forces domestically in Pakistani civil society and politics that that we can look to try to support in doing that? And what, from the U.S. perspective, does it have any leverage to actually help those forces?
Well, I'll start. I will say, oddly enough, given how bad the circumstances have gotten in this part of Pakistan, some of Pakistani military would need to be not just permissive, but actually an ally in these efforts. You've heard some of the reports of the Pakistani army's efforts of counter-extremism and getting together some of the young people in SWAT, right, to try to teach them the error of their ways and so on. These are very, very tiny efforts. And yet, they're basically right in terms of what their goals are. And I think that those, we can't write off the most powerful institution in Pakistan, that is the army, when it comes to trying to bring about change in places where the army is really the only tool of the state that is functioning. So it's a difficult partner because the army is on the one hand doing things that you don't want to see, and on the other hand, it's a big organization, parts of it are doing things that you might like to see. So encouraging that development, certainly not the only thing, and it doesn't qualify as civil society by any stretch, but it's not bad to applaud when you see something that they may be doing that's right. And then there's the broader question of Pakistani society. There, I think the political parties, all of them, I've been deeply frustrated with, and I find them terribly flawed. But they're better than the alternative of seeing the army come back in throughout the country, so they need to be supported at that level. And the media, also deeply frustrating and flawed, but also needs to be supported. And I would say the media is probably, in some ways, a better angle to pursue. We've seen the media be particularly under the gun, almost literally, of late. I think that's something that needs to be called out, attention drawn to that. And that would be an area where outsiders can have a positive role to play.
I think we should look. I actually agree with what Dan's saying, because the Pakistan military is a very problematic entity, but it is part of every solution that you can think of. There is no solution possible that removes or sidelines the Pakistan army. It is absolutely essential. Secondly, the whole business of Fatah, I think, is being overplayed. Because, as Dan said, the people who are foolish or desperate enough to remain there are there, and actually that operation is already underway. It is happening. The issue is not about the Taliban or the extremists in North Waziristan or in Fatah more generally. It is about those in Karachi, in southern Punjab, in parts of Balochistan. And like I said, so it's spread out. So, in Waziristan, it's relatively easy, actually, if you decide to go after this to do it. Also, interestingly, and you've worked in SWAT, the Pakistan Army has shown us that it can conduct an operation. The hold phase, as we know, is very different in SWAT. But the SWAT operation was conducted, whatever it was, 2 million people left the valley. They came back in with remarkably few violations of international humanitarian law, given the scale and scope of what happened. So actually, if the military wants to, it can transact a fight that is not abusive and brutal. I think Swartz showed us that. Certainly, it was not my expectation that it would. Subsequently, of course, when we got to the whole phase, we had the whole business of targeted killings and the beheadings and so on. But that was a whole. It wasn't violations in the course of war. So that's the other thing. And the final piece of this is actually what happens in Afghanistan, because Fazlullah, the TTP head, is actually sitting in Afghanistan. He is not in Pakistan. And one of the problems, and I was very unsympathetic to this, a few years ago, and over time I've understood that there is something to be said for this. There is, the Pakistan army will tell you that there is this very high expectation from us, particularly from the US, you are letting this happen. And they say, well, there are all these troops in Afghanistan. Why can't the US go and stop Fazlullah or elements of the Haqqanis who are there? And the thing is that this is a very difficult terrain. None of this is easy for anybody. And of course, the Pakistan army does what Pakistan does in general and is very good at that. Well, if I can't really, kill you, then you've got to be my friend. That's a lot of these alliances are a function of necessity rather than desire, and of course a lot of them are just what they are, which is a choice.
Thanks very much. I think we'll open it up to questions from the audience. So if you have a question, you can just come up to the mic here, maybe briefly introduce yourself.
My name is Sanjay Patel. I work in the public health program here at Open Society. Before I ask my two questions, I just want to commend Ali on your work. I've read your writings. You're a staunch advocate for rights and a great personal risk, so I'm really happy that you're here. So the two questions, one is for both of you, actually, and I'm sure it's one of the thousand questions Chris sent to you, but it didn't actually get addressed, which is drone strikes. I was just wondering if you could maybe unpack the implications of that, pros, cons. I think that would be interesting to hear your analysis on that. The question I have for you, Ali, is just to build on a question Chris posed and Dan touched on about the need for identifying indigenous actors within Pakistan in order to advance this kind of non-securitized dialogue in order to combat the securitized frame. Of course, we have a foundation in Pakistan. And I was just wondering if you could, since you are in Pakistan, describe the things that the foundation has been doing well in this regard and things that could be improved.
As far as the drones are concerned, look, my position, which is a human rights position, is as follows. Drone strikes, as they occur without oversight or accountability, are illegal under international law, and really should not be taking place as they take place. Having said that, from a human rights perspective, if you were to make a league table of human rights abuses in Pakistan, areas and incidents and reasons why innocents and civilians die, drone strikes really don't figure in the top 10. It is an issue that is overplayed for reasons of politics within the domestic debate, and is actually used by the right wing in Pakistan to marginalize people who are anti-extremism and to demonize the US. The US is entirely complicit and cooperative in its own demonization in this situation. So, I mean, one doesn't know really what the solution to this is. But, so that's the thing. They're wrong. But no, they are not the principal problem in Pakistan. And no, extremism and militancy is not a function of drone strikes. And extremism and militancy will not end if drone strikes end. In fact, they haven't taken place for the last couple of months now. And that certainly hasn't led to an immediate end to suicide bombings. And love has not broken out.
I can pick up on. I think the interesting thing about drones, I mean, leaving aside the the legal aspect. I don't really come at it from sort of the international law perspective as much as I come at it from perspective of U.S. policy and history, which is a very short history of the use of drones in Pakistan. It's a decade old. Nek Mohammed was the first victim of a drone strike in 2004. And that history is fascinating because it's the development of a new technology of war alongside of a very uncertain manner of handling that technology and deep uncertainty about the direction that that technology might go by both the Pakistani government and the United States. So no one knew in 2004 what drones would look like in 2011 or how frequently they would be used, what the intensity of drone strikes would be during the Obama administration. Had they known that, had they known what this tool might amount to as a terrorist killing tool, the Pakistani government might have responded very differently from the outset. But the reality, as I understand it, is that the Pakistani government has ranged from, at the outset, not only condoning the use of drones, that is, President Musharraf personally gave a green light to the killing of Nek Mohammed by a U.S. drone in 2004. Not only was that the case, but even then went on to take the next step of taking responsibility for the strike and lying and saying that the Pakistanis had actually killed Nek Mohammed themselves. Over time, the messaging from the Pakistani side shifted, largely, as Ali pointed out, in response to a political reality as they felt it, and as in some ways they manufactured it, inside of Pakistan that was increasingly anti-drone. And so over time, the messaging shifted from public messaging shifted from we're doing it to of course we're not doing it, it's the Americans doing it and we want them to stop. The private messaging up until relatively recently remained constant. Keep doing it, it's okay. Then further that changed because of the acceleration, as I said, the use of the drone tool accelerated rapidly to the point that the message privately started to shift. And now we're in a position which is quite different from where we started, where I think the public Pakistani message and the private message are largely the same. Please stop. And they have stopped. And before they stopped over the past couple of months, they also were greatly reduced in terms of their frequency, partially because the public and private messaging from Pakistan was the same, and partially because the Obama administration, I think, for an entirely separate set of reasons, believed that their utility as a counterterrorism tool had sort of petered out, that the number of targets that were out there had been reduced. Now, none of this has anything to do really with international law, except for the question of whether, as a sovereign entity, the Pakistanis had in fact given an authority to the U.S. government for much of that period. I think we've now reached a position, and I've written about this, where we need a very different deal on drones with the Pakistanis. It's already out in the open in almost every possible way, so authorities from our side, from the U.S. side, ought to be shifted even more out in the open, away from the CIA, over to the Pentagon. There ought to be a mechanism, as there is in other theaters of war, for compensating victims and for assessing victim claims. This should be a piece of it. And then in return, and these are the things the United States can do, in return the Pakistani side needs to come forward and basically own this reality. If it's to persist, because the Pakistanis cannot themselves or will not go after certain international terrorists because the terrain is so difficult, they need to accept that they are working with the United States or permitting the United States to move forward. And that's a politically difficult thing for the Pakistani side to do. But it's this kind of compromise that would have to happen on both sides, because I don't think that the challenge of international terrorists based in parts of the remote parts of the Fatah, I don't think that's disappeared. And so I don't think that this White House is going to be content to sort of walk away from that problem. So that's the political reality on the Pakistani side, the political reality on the Washington side. There is, I think, a better compromise than where we are now, but we haven't gotten there yet.
Sorry, just to follow up on that real quick, because I know that drones is an issue that a lot of us here at Open Society and other organizations talk about. I guess I wonder, you know, do you think, I mean, especially given your comments, Ali, do you think that it is sort of strategically wrong, maybe to put it a bit strongly, for groups like Open Society and Human Rights Watch to focus on this issue, particularly coming at it from not the sort of political and security perspective that Dan has highlighted and has identified as the real drivers of change, but from an international law and justice perspective. I mean, this is something that your own organization, as well as here, we talk about a lot and are investing resources in. So is this worthwhile?
No, I think it's actually absolutely essential from an international law and justice perspective to critique and bring up the issue of drones and engage with them, because it's a much bigger issue than just Pakistan or Yemen. You know, it's not about countries. The issue is much bigger. What I'm saying is that one has to be careful in how it is, what relevance it is to differentiate between drones as an international justice, international law issue, and drones as they are playing out in a given theater. And what I'm saying to you is that the Pakistani right wing, Taliban apologists in Pakistan, such as Imran Khan and affiliated Islamists, have latched onto the drone issue, which they present as a rights abuse, but actually what they are perpetuating through it is an anti-rights, very abusive agenda. And there has to be a very clear understanding of that. So when, for example, an organization like Reprieve goes in and allies itself with Imran Khan, they are doing themselves no favors, because they're actually feeding into a hate agenda rather than a rights agenda.
Just on that, I would only say there is a broader question of international precedent when it comes to the use of drones. But in my little world, in terms of how do you make arguments to U.S. policymakers about what is meaningful and what's likely to change their minds, the international precedent argument hasn't yet got the power of the practical utility argument or the political consequence argument, that is, on-the-ground political consequence. Over time, this may be shifting. I mean, as Ali is pointing out, I mean, the drone issue is not going away. Not only that, it's internationalizing. That is, we won't be the only country that has armed drones and will use them in various ways. So the question of what kind of precedent we are establishing for the future will start to weigh more heavily, I think, in policymaker minds. It just hasn't been a driver for policy change yet, nor do I think it is likely to be in the next couple of years in the Pakistan case.
Great, thanks. Sorry, next question.
Hi, my name is Neil Feldman. I'm now an arts journalist at Brooklyn, but in a prior life I was a Middle East and military security analyst. So this is, I'm just saying, the prior life question. About Pakistan, you both touched upon these points, and it is the issue of what type of nation is Pakistan in terms of what it wants to be. I apologize, I forget the name of the governor who was murdered by one of his own bodyguards because he questioned the blasphemy law, and there was a small army of attorneys volunteering to defend him. You know, the issue of, is that a civil society where that supports, murdering, that murder is the correct response to opposing a blasphemy law? You know, so that's one question, the nature of what is, because there are elements of Pakistan who are very modern, very sophisticated, and others that are, one notch away from, maybe not a notch away from, Iranian theocracy, style theocracy. And the other question, and you were talking about the issue of the military and going into Waziristan, doing what at some level what needs to be done, and so the question there in terms of what type of military is the Pakistani military, given a mindset of a professional Pakistani military that's been all about preparing to have another war with India. That's the traditional enemy, India. The nuclear weapons were not developed for tribes people, they were developed to fight India. And no matter what, that's what the Pakistani military has been trained over years to think about.
Well, in fact, as
if that's the right word, the peacenicks in the Pakistan army will tell you, the nukes were developed to not fight India rather than to fight India. But look, the point is that when any society is, you know, part progressive, cutting edge, modern, part medieval, I mean, it's the same thing about the US. So it's not, I mean, there is a complexity, and yes, the governor was murdered, and yes, there is a deep-rooted, like I say, militancy and extremism fault line, bigotry fault line even, that runs through Pakistani society. There is also a great culture of tolerance that runs through Pakistani society in both these things. Neither of these two things is the issue. The point is that, you know, you can't have a thought police. You can't turn people, force people to not be bigoted if that's what they wish to be. The issue is of the rate of the state. The issue is of the rule of law. And the issue is that you cannot get away with murder. You may not kill me if you think that I'm a heretic. Don't invite me to your house, you know. That's the difference, and that's actually the issue. So I don't think that there is this is a question of re-education. These are trends in society; they wax and wane. Yeah, certainly the madrasas have created an army of cannon fodder. There is a certain mindset that prevails. Those values of bigotry have been mainstreamed; they have been enabled. The state has created laws that actually provide cover for persecution. And these are all things that the state at its end has to deal with, political parties at their end have to deal with. But I mean, for example, even in the rights movement, there is this great tendency that we have where we reduce things to, for example, bad laws. And yeah, bad laws are a problem. But increasingly, my argument when I'm asked about, oh, what can the Pakistani state do about, for example, religious persecution? Well, yes, the Pakistani state can do the following things, and it can repeal following laws and reform them and so on. But there is something that society also has to do, because it is also a social problem. And it's a process that will happen over time. You have to create the space for an alternative conversation. The problem in Pakistan is that in recent years, that space to turn around and say, well, I don't think your interpretation of Islam is the right one, has been steadily eroded. And it is only up to political parties to demand that space back. It is not some political parties as the representatives of people in negotiation with elements of the state that exercise coercive authority, empowering the police itself to impose a rule of law. That's how it works, and I don't think that there is, you know, sort of a descent into darkness that is irreversible. I think that this is all about negotiating space and actually establishing the rule of law.
Yeah. The first piece of the question is sort of what makes Pakistan tick? How does Pakistan work? And in this book that I've written, I really try to get at that, and this issue of multiple Pakistans was the only way that I could try to address it. And I try to think about it in terms of sort of sketching different portraits, almost like a police sketch artist will take a witness testimony and try to put together a composite. And I talk about four different Pakistans and four different faces. And the first of these I talk about is basket case. I mean, is the state that doesn't work right. A feudally dominated, institutionally weak, infrastructurally failing, state that doesn't educate its people and so on. I mean, this is one version of Pakistan that has to be dealt with, has to be accepted as a reality. But the second face I talk about is a garrison state. That is a society that has been and continues to be in many ways dominated by the military as its most powerful institution. A third face, we talk about kind of a terrorist or jihadi incubator. These underlying networks of extremism, this rising sense of intolerance, this is another reality of Pakistan. And the whole country could be described that way, but it wouldn't be enough. And then a last phase, I talk about a youthful idealist, right? Because Pakistan is a country that's growing very rapidly. could be another 85 million people in the next several decades. That's the size of Iran, right, adding to this country. And many of these young Pakistanis, aren't interested in revolutionary change, but maybe pushed that way if they're not educated, if they don't find opportunities. Many of them seek evolutionary change, and they're worth supporting. And you saw some of that youthful idealism and energy in the last elections. They came out into the streets. I think they've been disappointed with the candidate, Imran Khan, who sort of stole a lot of that energy for his own purposes. But I don't think it's the last time, and I hope that the next election we see that again, that kind of energy. So it's only by putting these different portraits together in a composite that I think you begin to see that larger reality. The second point, what type of military is the Pakistani military? It is a military that has been kind of born and raised with the India threat as its defining feature, and yet it is also a military that over the past decade has had deployment after deployment after deployment on Pakistan's western front and has seen suffering up close and personal at all levels of its troops and its officers from that fight and not from the war with India. And so it has changed. And if you speak with military officers, so many of them have had to serve on the western side and have had to see that fight up close and personal that they've started to recognize that maybe India is the permanent threat, but the war on the West is the immediate threat.
Yeah.
And that's a shift. Yeah. That's an important shift. Now, how they interpret that, whether they connect the two in what I think are profoundly unhelpful ways and counterproductive ways, and whether they still try to draw distinctions between the good Taliban and the bad Taliban, and also what I think are counterproductive ways, that's a related but separate issue. They have begun to see a different and immediate threat that they need to confront. And I think that they're more or less on the same page.
Why is the U.S. drawing that distinction between the good Taliban and the bad Taliban?
Well, it's a good question. I think that it's been a profoundly mixed message. And for my own part, I've been critical of it. I think that we have, in our efforts to reach out to elements within the Afghan Taliban, we have sent a very confused message to other Afghans, to the Pakistanis, and to the wider region. And the outreach, which I know was born within the Obama administration out of a motivation to seek a political accommodation, so there's a reasonable logic to it, but was undertaken in a way that, first of all, hasn't worked as a practical reality, and secondly, has had only these counterproductive other outcomes. So I've been very worried about it. And, as I suggested in my opening remarks, I'm worried about what we leave behind in Afghanistan, what that will mean for Pakistan.
My name is Jennifer Lee Obermorgan, and I'm a national security and human rights journalist. And I have two questions for both of you, but they branch off part of each of your respective discussions. So the first question is actually branching off of a note that Mr. Hassan made earlier, that Pakistan doesn't speak with one voice. So I was wondering, the first question is, what voice, in your opinion, do you see the U.S. addressing, and which one should we be addressing? So where that disconnect occurs. And the second question is branching off of something that you said, when you said that this is really an Afghanistan story. So my question for you is whether, in your both opinions, if the U.S. didn't so adamantly push the implementation of democracy versus a political system that might have been a little less of a shock or paradigm shift to what Afghanistan had when we first went in, how that would have affected the political terrain of the Pakistan that we're discussing today.
Look, in terms of Pakistan, what I was describing was multiple centers of power, of which the military remains, of course, the most empowered and relevant. Now, chiefly, this is not something that actually the U.S. has much choice over, depending on what business it is transacting, it has to address all or the relevant parts of this power equation. Largely because this is a security-centered relationship, U.S. dealings are with their military-to-military dealings or their CIA-ISI dealings, and that's how they are pursued. So that's that. Secondly, I mean, Afghanistan is different because that is a nation-building exercise that the U.S. found itself engaged in. As far as Pakistan is concerned, it is a total misconception that the U.S. has ever plugged or propagated or really been engaged or concerned with democracy building or democracy strengthening in Pakistan. All periods of intensive U.S. engagement with Pakistan have resulted in an expansion of the Pakistani national security state. And U.S. priorities in Pakistan are not about democracy. It may be part of the sort of aspirational rhetoric of the U.S. that it wants democracy in Pakistan and across the world, and I'm sure it does. But that's not what the relationship with Pakistan is or has been about. There are periods, in moments in time, when, for reasons of exhaustion or exit, the U.S. can bring the Pakistani military and Pakistani political classes that are excluded to the table and facilitate a power-sharing agreement between them. This was done in 1988. It was done again in 2007-08. And that's pretty much it. There was some attempt, I think this time there was a slightly more strident rhetoric about it. There was the Kerry Lugar bill, but it all petered out pretty fast. And that's that. So no, I certainly in terms of Pakistan, democracy is not the issue. It's not part of the U.S. agenda, and it's not anywhere, I think, but really meaningful on the priority list.
I'll take a stab at the first, or the question addressed to me with respect to should we have pursued a different agenda in Afghanistan. Yes, but in so many different ways that it's hard to identify exactly where I would put the sort of the original sin. In my work, I've tried to identify where things went wrong, particularly with respect to our dealings with Pakistan. And I would say probably it came about, I don't think we had ever a meeting of the minds with the Pakistani state about our agenda in Afghanistan. But we did, at the very outset, have essentially a very powerful coercive tool that got the Pakistanis marginally on board with our agenda. And that was true from 2001, September, up until about 2003, at which point we very much took our eye off the ball in Afghanistan and moved on to Iraq. And it was in that time frame, and as a consequence of that, and that clear distraction, and the sense that, from the Pakistani perspective, that we actually weren't doing the kinds of things that they thought we were going to do in Afghanistan if we were serious about stabilizing the place and making it work in some longer-term sense. The Pakistanis, I think, were surprised at how our limited capability, our limited attention span, the limited resources we were devoting to this place. I think the Pakistani attitude was, oh, they're not serious. And that led us to a further divergence, right? That the initial convergence was only out of coercion and only lasted as long as it was clear that we were serious, or it seemed that we were serious, and that our coercion was in place. The Pakistani government under Musharraf was willing to play along. But as that became less and less clear, that divergence manifested itself to the point that we were very clearly on different sides in the Afghanistan war over time. Then on this point that Ali makes about the U.S. role in democracy building in Pakistan, this is another thing. You know, I worked at the State Department 2003 to 2007. I watched very closely and with great concern about a lot of our understanding of and preparations for sort of the end of the Musharraf regime. And a lot of this question about the sort of promotion of democracy and so on within Pakistan, none of it worked out particularly well. And it has led, and this has led me to think, you know, in a deeper historical sense, about some of the roots of anti-American sentiment in Pakistan. And in the book, I trace different strands of anti-Americanism. One of them is a sort of a left-liberal Pakistani anti-Americanism born of the sense that we have been hypocritical in our application of our own constitutional principles in our dealings with Pakistan. And I think, you know, this is actually a very small number of people in Pakistan, but they're very well educated. They're very articulate, often in positions of political leadership and influence. And they're natural allies that we would, in an ideal world, want to cultivate. We have lost many of them, and I've dealt with them. I mean, I deal with them all the time because they're the ones you're most likely to come in contact with, and they're deeply disillusioned with the United States, but for reasons completely different from the broader disillusionment with the United States that had more to do with our policies in the 65 war, the 71 war, and, you know, a sense of abandonment at the end of the Cold War. That's a kind of a center-center-right frustration with the United States. This is a center-center-left liberal frustration with the United States that has a very different motivation to it, but continues to be powerful and important in Pakistan.
Thanks very much. Maybe let's just take these last two. Was there? Oh, yeah.
We take the last two questions
together, maybe, and then we can close out. Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Nader Gabol, and I'm just a young, average Pakistani who feels that we're being bullied into accepting this whole issue with the drones, and that our sovereignty as a nation is being challenged. At the same time, I have a very favorable view of the American people because I went to school here and I've been working here for a couple of years. So I'd like to see that this whole sovereignty thing and being bullied thing should go away from the hearts of the majority of Pakistanis, especially the young ones. So my question is, like, okay, there are benefits of these drone strikes, but there's a lot of negatives as well. And as I think Dan mentioned, that there's people in the Pakistani ruling class who are giving green signals to this whole drone thing. So why can't we work with the Pakistanis and the Americans together and give some control over the drone strikes to the Pakistani military? Because I think Dan mentioned it. The military can be trusted in the sense that it is kind of organized and efficient and it does work. So why can't we, like, work together and achieve these targets?
My name is Melissa Lapis from the Global Center on Cooperative Security, and my question is for Ali, if you could speak to the criminal justice response to extremism, the role that the anti-terrorism courts are playing, how they're perceived in the public, and your thoughts on that. Thank you.
Very briefly on the drones, you know, I don't understand it, because if there is anger at a loss of sovereignty and the sovereign authority is complicit in your perceived loss of sovereignty, I don't know what sort of the solution to that is. I remember General Musharraf said many years ago, General Musharraf actually said something far more interesting. He said, I told the US, why don't you let us pretend that it's our drones? And I'm sure how realistic he was being, but then he's proved himself not to be a very realistic person. But Dan can perhaps speak to that better.
Do you want to take the second one on the law enforcement?
Law enforcement. Look, the entire sort of anti-terrorism legal structure sucks. It's the Anti-Terrorism Act is draconian, it is ridiculous, and mostly what is transacted under it is not terrorism. Basically you can charge just about anybody with anything. I could go back and be charged under the Anti-Terrorism Act for something I may have said here. You can go and do graffiti on the wall, and that's terrorism. And now, apparently, if you elope with someone's wife, that's also terrorism, which is a fun twist to infidelity. And in any case, there are all these anti-terrorism courts and ATCs, and there are these cases pending for years and years and years, thousands of cases. The judges themselves, the courts are poorly funded. The judges themselves are terrified of convicting extremists who, even from prison, exercise a lot of authority, including the power of life and death over everybody, including the judge in question, who may have the temerity to sentence them. So it doesn't work. There is the solution to that in Pakistan always has been to come up with yet more draconian legislation. So now we have this crazy thing called the Protection of Pakistan Ordinance. The PPO, and there are other amendments to the Anti-Terrorism Act. And basically what the Protection of Pakistan Ordinance does is that it inverts all the basic principles of justice. You are guilty until you prove yourself innocent. You can be held indefinitely. without charge, and so on. And none of it actually deals with terrorism, because actually counterterrorism is transacted under the radar, and it is people, there are thousands of people in Swat and elsewhere in a legal black hole being held illegally under perpetuity, in perpetuity, and the way of sort of giving that legal cover is not to say, or retrospectively from, you know, antiquity, we've been holding you legally, which is what the Protection of Pakistan Ordinance does. And this is one of the problems. I mean, if you look at Swat and those places, one of the reasons why you had this rise of the TTP was because there was a legal vacuum and a justice vacuum and a conflict resolution, the absence of a conflict resolution mechanism. And one of the best ways, actually, of ensuring and establishing the writ of the state is to actually have the state dispense viable justice. And I don't understand why there is almost a laziness to it. It is not just a lack of will. It is because the Pakistani state, actually the post-colonial South Asian state, they are opaque by structurally. They don't like accountability. They like to be able to crush dissent, particularly at the fringes. This is equally true of India, of Bangladesh, of Sri Lanka, of course, and so on. So the thing is that it's part of that culture, and unless this is reformed and resolved, and how do you do it? You do it by having an independent judiciary. Well, we struggled and got Pakistan an independent judiciary. We had Tarzan as Chief Justice. And then, did he do anything about reforming the legal system? Did he do anything about improving access to justice? No. This is one of those issues, and there is a perpetual argument between people like me who are asking for this kind of thing, and everybody across the board in the Pakistani state, and in this the Pakistani military, leads the pack, which is that they want impunity laws to transact effective counterterrorism. And actually the impunity law only exacerbates extremism and doesn't deal with the problem. But there is no will, and there is almost a tunnel vision about this. There are these things are so mainstream that if you look at Pakistani cases, legal documents, virtually everybody who enters a police station is tortured. And it does not even occur to a defense lawyer to record the fact that this, you know, it is a given that you were arrested by the police, you were hung upside down and thrashed. And people will appear in court in a state of physical disrepair, and the judge disregards it, and your defense lawyer doesn't make an issue of it. And it's all kind of, it's a bigger problem. And it has to begin with legal reform, but there is no sign of it as of now.
This, I'll pick up on the issue of potential cooperation on drones. I mean, as I suggested before, I think that's broadly where we would want to get to, but it's not just drones. It's across the board in terms of we would want to have a situation where the United States and Pakistan see security threats in similar enough terms that we can cooperate more or less transparently in the sharing of intelligence, in operational planning, and so on. That's where we would want to be. But when you go down the list of some of the crises in the U.S.-Pakistan relationship over the past several years, they have one thing in common, which is we haven't seen the threat in similar terms. I mean, if you look at Raymond Davis, I mean, why was Raymond Davis in Lahore doing what presumably he was doing for the CIA? It's because presumably the CIA thought that the Pakistani state was not doing what it wanted to do in terms of going after organizations like Lashkar-e-Taiba. And why was he doing it secretly? Because the Pakistani state wouldn't have let him do it otherwise. Right? So there's a clear difference there in terms of trust and in terms of assessing who the threats are. The Osama bin Laden raid. Why was it done, and I believe that this is the case, done without telling anybody in the Pakistani state that it was going to happen? Because there was no trust that had they done so, had the Obama administration done so, that the Pakistanis wouldn't have somehow done something to make the mission more difficult. Right? Lacking that kind of trust, and then when you you expand upon that to the comments that then Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff made on Capitol Hill about the Haqqani network being, as he put it, a veritable arm of the Pakistani state. If there's that degree of mistrust, then you're not going to see cooperative arrangement on drone targeting. When you begin to see that sense of who you're going after being similar targets, then you have an opening for cooperation on drones or just about anything else.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you all for coming today. And as Dan said, there's a lot of pieces to this puzzle, and there's a lot of different issues at play here, and it's very complicated. But I think our panel has done a good job of trying to clarify those for us, and especially to try to identify, looking ahead, what are the biggest threats that we should be thinking about, what are the different dynamics, and particularly where there can be potentially some space for trying to increase open society and the values that we work on here. So thank you very much, and please join me in thanking our panelists.